As long as growth and employment rates are the measures of a healthy economy, our environmental interests will be at war with our economic interests, and what is good for capital will be seen as what's good for everyone. To break with the dominant way of understanding the world that offers us either cosmopolitan capitalism or nativist capitalism, we need to engage with people outside of our progressive bubbles and build a new common sense based on our view of a socially and economically just and environmentally sustainable future.
That's Cynthia Kaufman, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Cynthia Kaufman on capitalism, getting past it. The present phase of capitalism is a great success story for the uber-rich. Torrents of wealth flow overwhelmingly to a sliver of the population. Millennials in large numbers are seriously questioning the existing economic order. They are even willing to, hold your breath, consider a socialist alternative. The Bernie Sanders campaign made a huge impact on many young people and sparked interest in socialism. When millennials hear the term capitalism, they think about Wall Street bailouts, corporate greed, offshore accounts, and a tax code riddled with loopholes for the well-connected. The vaunted invisible hand feels like a death grip for far too many. Now is the time to think outside the box. As George Monbiot writes in The Guardian, it's not enough to oppose a broken system. A coherent alternative has to be proposed. Our guest today is Cynthia Kaufman. She's the director of the Institute of Community and Civic Engagement at De Anza College in San Francisco, where she also teaches philosophy. She's the author of Getting Past Capitalism. She spoke in Fresno, California. And now, Cynthia Kaufman.
With the election of Trump as president, the Republican majority in both houses, and a scary balance on the Supreme Court, we are in such a hard time that it almost doesn't seem right to be talking about moving forward and getting past capitalism. Right now, I think it seems as though preventing fascism is perhaps the most we can hope for. And yet, I think it is important that we hold on to our larger vision of a better world, even as we engage in a lot of defensive battles. One reason for this is it can help orient us in doing our defensive work to remember what we're fighting for and to be inspired by our belief that another world is possible. In 1994, when the Zapatistas came out of the jungle opposing the North American Free Trade Agreement and declaring really boldly that another world is possible, I saw how important it was actually to dream of a better world, even in hard times, and to have a sense of the direction we want society to move in, even when we don't think we're going to get there anytime soon. That sense of hope and vision helps us to be inspiring to others and to pull them into our movements. And it also helps us decide which things to work on and which are the most important negative things to challenge. I see something helpful in the utopian work also of those who are building alternative economies in the present time. While we won't stop capitalism merely by building worker-owned cooperatives or going to farmers' markets, there's something important in starting right here and right now to build the better world that so many of us desire. And I'm going to come back to some ideas about that later in the talk. The other reason why I think it's important in these really hard times to talk about getting past capitalism is that in the United States, as in many other countries, the neoliberal consensus that supported a slightly benign form of capitalism has been shattered. And that presents incredible opportunities for those of us who want to get past capitalism that I hadn't been able to imagine a couple years ago. We can see this in Europe as well as in the United States, where the old political parties have totally lost credibility because of their inability to protect people's standards of living from rising inequality and a dominance of our lives by the banks and the hedge funds. We're at a crossroads in many places in the world right now. Hillary Clinton's loss was importantly a loss about the inability of her particular brand of neoliberal capitalism to inspire people enough to come out and vote for her. That presents an opportunity for those of us who oppose capitalism to build support for our vision of a better world. Before returning to talk later some more about the electoral situation we're in this country, I want to digress a little bit and talk about capitalism and why we need to get past it. I believe that capitalism rewards greed and fosters a society in which it is hard for people to pay good, productive attention to the needs of others and to the way that we are all interconnected. But I also realize that many people see it as the only viable form of society in the modern world. Wondering about capitalism has pushed me to think a lot about what other kinds of economic and political systems might be possible. Although I'm opposed to capitalism, I'm not opposed to all uses of market mechanisms, to trade, or to entrepreneurship. Each of those things can play a positive role in an economy under the right circumstances. But investment for profit becomes a problem when profit-making consumes such a significant part of society's resources that investors gain the power to transform our cultural and political systems. When capitalists control a political system, other ways of living and using resources are drowned out. Capitalism is a problem because it allows those with resources to use them without regard to the needs of others. That disregard leads to a destruction of communities, to millions of people around the world not having access to the basic things they need to live healthy lives, and to environmental degradation. Capitalism is one of the most important forces responsible for the fact that most people don't have time to do the things that they love. Along with racism and sexism, capitalism is a powerful force for generating and maintaining devastating forms of inequality. It is largely to blame for the slow response to the global catastrophe being caused by climate change. But how do we undo capitalism, a system that has been developing and growing for more than 500 years? By this point, capitalism has become a central part of the fabric of most societies that we inhabit. How do we dismantle the capitalist home we live in when our activities every day effectively shore it up? No matter how anti-capitalist you are, if you live in a society dominated by capitalism, you probably need to work for a wage. Most of us spend many of our waking hours doing paid work and much of our leisure time shopping and otherwise consuming capitalist culture. Capitalism even structures our intimate relationships. We often express love by buying things for people, and we often judge people based on the products that they use. When capitalism comes to dominate society, when all other ways of meeting our needs come to be devalued and pushed out, when governments operate to serve the interests of privately owned capital rather than the needs of people, we have a serious problem, and we should name that problem as capitalism. I decided to write my book, Getting Past Capitalism, History, Vision, Hope, to help social justice activists like myself, and I actually, for myself, writing the book was really clarifying for things that I had been deeply confused about. Who see capitalism as a problem, to be able to have a sense of realistic ways forward to act on our anti-capitalism, even in times when the revolution is not looming. Important to that vision of practical anti-capitalism is the idea that there are many alternatives to capitalism that we live in right now, that capitalism is not our whole society, but rather a nasty set of practices that are parasitic upon a whole functioning fabric of social relations that work well and that need to be expanded. To me, it's exciting to think that there are realistic alternatives to capitalism, that we thrive in many of those alternatives right now, that society can be transformed to the extent that those alternatives can become stronger and more predominant in our lives. We can begin to think of fighting capitalism as we think of fighting a fungus or a virus that has damaged our body politic. It has become entangled with our cells and needs to be fought from within and from without with complementary treatments. If we can see capitalism as a set of interrelated practices, we can also see its connections for what they are and not overstate the extent to which they are fused together in a system. We need to develop ways of conceptualizing capitalism that render it solid enough for patterns to be revealed and yet open enough to see the places where it is vulnerable. Metaphors and images are central to the ways we understand and use concepts, and if our common metaphors and images fail to reflect our reality, our thoughts can be structured in ways that don't serve us well. Capitalism is reinforced by the image of a market functioning beautifully by means of an imaginary hand, effortlessly allocating resources where they need to go. It is helped by powerful confusion in people's minds between freedom and democracy in the world of politics and the freedoms of markets and corporations. Instead of an image of a world composed of rational, competitive individuals, each fighting to get as many resources for him or herself as possible, we need to develop an image of society as a tapestry of people and all of nature interlinked in a common fate. Imagine our different languages and cultures as a variety of patterns that reveal common as well as unique solutions to the problems of being human. Think of capitalism as a fungus that has dulled the colors of the tapestry and weakened its fibers. Only by diligently cleaning every strand and warp and woof of every embroidery stitch that is implicated in capitalist processes can we create a human tapestry with greater beauty and brilliance. Think of pulling capitalist elements from the social fabric and replacing them with other social forms. The pulling, cutting, and reweaving must happen at many social locations, from the land and rivers where food and water is drawn each year to laboratories where new treatments for disease are developed. Pulling threads in one place often causes holes in other places, and as we reweave society, we need to attend to the short-term problems that our actions can take. We need to create a better world while still inhabiting the fabric of the one we want to challenge. This image of reweaving a tapestry is intended to bring to mind the idea of a constant remaking of the intricate nature of capitalist processes and of the ways that change on a macro scale is made up of changes on a micro scale. We are constantly making and remaking society every day in all of our human interactions. For many years, I've listened carefully to how people who see capitalism as a problem talk about it in their political work. Usually, it's spoken of as a limit. They suggest that we can only do so much to change a situation, but once the problem we're dealing with goes up against capitalism, we should probably give up. Capitalism, after all, is simply our condition. There is nothing short of world revolution that will make that condition change. Opponents to capitalism are long on critiques and very short on positive steps for doing anything about it. Many people doing important political work might characterize their work as only reformist. Seeing no alternative to capitalism, they soldier on doing what they know needs to be done. But imagine the excitement and inspiration they might gain if they could see their efforts as part of a long-term project of getting rid of capitalism. How we think about the nature of capitalism has huge implications for how we are to think about anti-capitalism. If we accept the picture of capitalism as a robust, adaptable system that can create every sort of social effect it needs to keep itself functioning, then it's likely that we'll see schools, for example, as nothing more than factories for the production of workers, governments as nothing more than agents of the ruling class, household labor as something created by the capitalists for the reproduction of the workforce. Within this view, the agent called capitalism makes these things happen to keep itself functioning and co-opts or destroys every effort made to challenge this. Capitalism comes to be like the Terminator, destroying all in its path and powerful in its ability to fight off challengers, changing form and shape when needed, and always intent on its goal of destroying human resistance. Even more powerful than the Terminator, capitalism is seen as having such a high level of cunning that only its own internally created crisis point will make it vulnerable enough for it to ever be destroyed. And there are good reasons why people who oppose capitalism are inclined to see it as a totalistic system. I think it's helpful. It's a helpful antidote to a kind of thinking which is endemic to capitalist society, where people don't see the connections between social processes. Karl Marx's critique of capitalism remains unparalleled in its insight into the ways that capitalism operates and the problems that it causes. And yet many within the Marxist tradition have relied on ways of analyzing the problem that make it difficult to imagine realistic approaches to anti-capitalist politics. How can we separate those totalizing threads from our tapestry and envision more promising ways to challenge capitalism? There is a tradition on the left of dismissing as reformist any action not specifically designed to instigate a revolution to smash the state and overthrow capitalism. Early theorists of capitalism believed that the only two options were violent revolution to overthrow capitalism or reformism that made life a little bit better but accepted capitalism as a given. Ideas of revolution have focused on taking state power or overthrowing a government as the only path to a world beyond capitalism. But when we ask strategic questions about what aspects of capitalism might need to be challenged first, it's not at all clear that taking state power should be the first or even an early aspect of an anti-capitalist movement. You can overthrow a group of people who are governing a political system, and those who take power can expropriate some or all of the economic resources held by the owning class. But when this has been done in the past, the very processes of holding state power and defending anti-capitalist changes has led to social and political clampdown, as occurred in most of the governments that call themselves anti-capitalist, like the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, Stalinist repression inhibited the very deep transformation of other aspects of society that had actually begun when the revolution first started. The idea of revolution encourages us to focus on governments and to forget the non-dramatic, slow building and reweaving that goes beyond state power. The image of revolution as a dramatic moment of overthrow also encourages us to suppose that at some point when you do anti-capitalist work, you're done. Our historical experience of anti-capitalist struggle has shown that the work of getting past capitalism has never reached a final point in any geographic locality. Wherever there has been an anti-capitalist revolution, forces attempting to reinstate capitalism have in every instance persisted in attempting to subvert anti-capitalist gains. Even if capitalism were someday reduced to almost nothing, it would seem wise to be continually on the lookout for new accumulations of power based on private appropriation of public goods, which I think is one of the core ways to understand what capitalism is. If capitalism were a structure like a building, it might make sense to focus on taking it down by overthrowing it. But if it's deeply woven into the social fabric, then overthrow isn't the right metaphor to use to understand how to destroy it. We need instead to untie the knots that bind us to it. We need to reweave the social fabric in ways that don't rely on it, that are resistant to it. We need to develop ways of thinking that are about what we were doing that value the slow process of transforming every aspect of our society, what Rudy Dutschke in 1968 called the long, slow march through the institutions, which don't rely on some future grand moment of contestation. We need to develop ways of thinking about anti-capitalism that foster vigilance against the undermining and destruction of the good things that we create. The idea of revolution is a powerful, inspirational image if it conjures up in our minds the idea that capitalism needs to be completely eliminated. The idea of revolution can inspire us to imagine an outside to capitalist relations. It can mean that another world is possible. But revolution also needs to be understood as a complex, multifaceted, never-ending process that takes place at all social levels. Organizing to get past capitalism involves understanding the social patterns that make capitalism happen. In the book, I argue that the means by which capitalism is perpetuated can be grouped into four main forms of agency. Okay, now I'm going to start getting a little more specific. Systems of desire and meaning among the general population, that's one. Different ways that the owning class comes together to act as an agent, the state or the government, and a problem that I call the economic dependency trap of capitalism. As capitalism has developed, each of these forms of agency has evolved in ways that expand the degree to which capitalism has come to work as a dominant set of threads holding together and reproducing patterns in our social lives. So now I want to explain each of these forms of agency in a little bit of detail. Okay, so number one, systems of desire and meaning. Marx's concept of ideology is a good first approximation at describing the way systems of ideas help to reproduce capitalism. In one of his most famous phrases for describing ideology, Marx writes that, quote, the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas, unquote. The owning class, or as Marx says here, the ruling class, is able to influence the ways people think about the world through its impact on schools, the media, religion, artistic production, etc. Through ideological processes, owning class ways of looking at the world and ways of understanding the world that favor the owning class come to have powerful effects on the systems of ideas in any society. But the concept of ideology can be overly simplistic if ideology means that all of the dominant ideas of society will be the ideas of the ruling class. From this functionalist perspective, it's hard to see how we challenge capitalist ideology. We can come to feel powerless in the face of a ruling class that always gets its way. Capitalist ways of being in the world structure our lives at a much deeper level than the concept of ideology expresses. Ideology does not simply overlay a set of beliefs onto an otherwise blank slate, as if our views had nothing to do with when and how we were raised and the cultures we inhabit. As such, we need concepts that acknowledge how capitalist ideas are not spread homogeneously across the social fabric. We need to look at the complex ways that they are woven into our human experience in much of the world. Living in a society dominated by capitalism, we inhabit a world where pleasure is increasingly structured as something to be bought. Fulfillment is conceived as something to be attained through the consumption of commodities. If we don't make conscious choices or have a clear sense of our options, we can reproduce capitalist ways of being in the world for ourselves and for others by following the expected ways of being. These practices then become memes or self-reproducing practices. Understanding the cultural memes that support capitalism will help open the way for imagining how to get past capitalism. Capitalism is built on John Locke's meme of people as fundamentally separate from one another and individual at our core. It is built on the meme of fusing capitalism with democracy in our imaginations. It relies on the meme of magical but delicate market forces conjuring up wealth but whose functioning is so fragile that any tinkering will destroy the magic of the market. Another meme is the shadow image of the only alternative to capitalism as a police state in which people have no control over their lives and where everyone is poor and no one has any motivation to better themselves. In the US, one of the most prevalent pro-capitalist memes is that of upward mobility. Deep in our culture are beliefs that anyone can make it if they try, and working for a wage is morally righteous, and those who have not made it are lazy, immoral, or simply happy being poor. Making it in this society comes to be defined in terms of wealth, and the trappings of wealth are taken as the signs of a good life. Not surprisingly, theorists have found across many different societies that above an income level of about $10,000 per year, there is absolutely no correlation between happiness and wealth. The strongest correlates of happiness are health and a sense of connection to others. Yet the belief that happiness comes from wealth is so deeply embedded in our culture that many people, when they look into their hearts and ask what they want from life, find that what they want is material wealth, fame, and beauty, which all can be bought, right? Much of the work of replicating capitalism occurs through memes that are deeply embedded in our social forms that are not necessarily the result of the action of individuals working consciously to promote capitalism. No one needs to figure out how to promote consumerism as a way of life for it to be perpetuated ever more deeply into our social fabric. Each capitalist firm pursuing its own self-interest will look for ways to sell its product. Commercial media, which survive on advertising, create a welcoming space for those messages. Individuals who live in an environment saturated with such messages and with little free time to pursue other ways of being come to desire consumption as a way of living, and therefore they end up reproducing capitalism through the ways that they actually live out their desires that they find themselves having. The second thing I want to talk about is the owning class. Those viral forms of agency that perpetuate capitalism through consumer culture are often supplemented, especially in times of crisis, by intentional forms of agency on the part of the owning class. Where there are movements that threaten the powers and privileges of the owning class, that class often comes together as an intentional agent to fight back. The owning class often functions as what Marx called a class for itself, that is, a class which knows its interests and operates effectively and often with brutality and violence to protect those interests. As sociologist William Robinson has argued, there is a transnational capitalist class still in the process of development that works to create optimal conditions for transnational forms of capitalism. The nation-state came into being over the past few hundred years while capitalism was also coming into being. As such, ways of serving the needs of capitalism have become deeply embedded in the form and functioning of nation-states. As transnational capitalism is developing, a set of transnational institutions to support it is also starting to develop. Robinson argues that this transnational state is not so much displacing nation states as it is linking them together under the predominance of transnational institutions such as the European Union, NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, and those annual meetings that the very wealthy have in Davos, Switzerland every year. The owning class works quite intentionally to create conditions for the functioning of capitalism as a whole, for the success of their specific businesses, and for the interests of the owning class as a class. As such, it is one of the main forms of agency that operates to reproduce capitalism. This owning class operates through its business practices, through setting up think tanks to perpetuate its ideas, through control over media, through pushing for specific forms of legislation at every level of government. And at the transnational level, these forces fight for institutions such as the World Trade Organization. At the national level, they work together for particular labor laws, tax policies, and trade agreements. At the local level, they make sure that developers are favored in planning processes, so the owning class has many powerful tools at its disposal. And one of its most powerful tools is that it can influence governments, referred to in political theory as states, that then define themselves and become other agents of capitalism. So the third form of agency I want to talk about that reproduces capitalism is the state. One of the oddest things about capitalism is that it is often thought of as if it were an independent set of practices having nothing to do with government. Markets are imagined to be completely autonomous and self-replicating. Governments are seen as prone to meddle with capitalism that does better when it operates on its own. And yet, in many ways, the state is a necessary twin of a capitalist economy. Capitalism arose at the same time as parliamentary democracy in Europe. Many members of the owning class advocated for parliamentary democracy in the early days of capitalism as a way to challenge the forms of authority and governmental structures that existed under feudalism. In doing this, they created a political space for their own rise to power. But this alliance between capitalists and advocates of democracy has always proven to be quite unstable. From the beginning, the democratic governments that emerged out of the European Enlightenment were, on the one hand, mechanisms for people to be able to express their desires and interests, and on the other hand, mechanisms for the protection of the conditions required for a capitalist economy to function. An important part of capitalism from its very beginning has been the use of violence to protect the conditions necessary for resource extraction, to thwart the militancy of labor, to control and empower undocumented immigrants, and to get surplus populations, so-called, off the streets with mass incarceration. Governments have been dependable in their ability to mobilize violence to serve the needs of the owning class. And the fourth and final form of agency that I want to talk about is the economic dependency trap of capitalism. Working class people in a capitalist society need a wage to get the money they need to get the resources they need to survive. In many places in the world, capitalism operates according to a basic compromise. The workers will fight with capitalists over how much of the surplus will go to the workers and how much will go to the owners, and they will fight for improved working conditions. People as a whole might fight through the state to constrain somewhat the operations of businesses. But everyone challenging capitalism in this way knows that their demands are limited by what a company can afford and still remain profitable, or by what a national economy can afford before the policies that are good for the population begin to be, quote, bad for the economy. That is counterproductive to attracting capital for investment in the economy. Even in the initial days of the disastrous BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, many people were opposed to limiting the extremely dangerous deep sea drilling that caused that because they were afraid that it would cost jobs. So we're always in this jobs versus society kind of a situation. There are many ways that this economic dependency trap of capitalism functions without any pro-capitalist forces having to take any concerted action to impose it on the working class people. It is simply true that a business pushed beyond profitability will cease to exist to employ people. And on a macro scale, any policies that make investing undesirable for business will lead to some levels of unemployment. Once a society comes to have a large enough capitalist sector, the economic dependency trap begins to function passively as one of the most powerful tools favoring the interests of capitalism. In addition to passively benefiting from this reality of capitalism, pro-capitalist forces also often work actively to make use of the vulnerabilities created by the economic dependency trap through strategies such as capital strike. Just as workers can combine to refuse to supply labor in order to increase their bargaining position, owners of capital can refuse to invest in towns or in countries which promote policies that are not conducive to the interests of the capitalist ruling class. Pro-capitalist forces use capital strike or the threat of a capital strike to constrain the policies of nation states, communities, and labor unions. The economic dependency trap of capitalism needs to be taken into account when constructing our anti-capitalist strategies. Anti-capitalist organizers will be severely limited and not likely to find much support if they advocate for policies that run directly against the ability of people to maintain their standard of living. Any anti-capitalist strategies which push us right up against capitalism's economic dependency trap need to be used with caution and with an understanding of what is likely to happen. When unions organize strikes, they almost always undertake an analysis of the profitability of a company. If it looks like the demands of the workers will make the company unprofitable enough that it can't compete, the union usually decides that those demands are unreasonable. When a socialist party comes to power through elections, it almost always looks at the ways that its policies will lead to capital flight, and it tries to balance the dependencies on those forms of capital that are likely to flee against policies that entice other forms of capital to remain. When a town raises taxes, it usually looks carefully at the businesses in its environment and is careful to find ways to not scare off too many businesses. Taking these steps is prudent, and anti-capitalists should not expect those trying to improve lives within the capitalist context to do otherwise. We can build powerful anti-capitalist strategies around shrinking the power of the capitalist vortex has on people's lives. One of the tools that pro-capitalist forces use is to exaggerate the power of the economic dependency trap, such that people are convinced that pro-capitalist policies are always essential to their personal well-being, or that without them, businesses will fail. Another tool is to spread the spread of pro-capitalist forms of desiring. Anti-capitalists can strengthen their position by supporting ways to meet our needs outside the nexus of consumerism and capitalist-mediated forms of desire. To the extent that we can generate non-capitalist forms of economic activity, we are also less dependent on capitalism for meeting our basic needs.
You're listening to Cynthia Kaufman on Capitalism, Getting Past It. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Exactly where and when capitalist practice will involve challenging states or working with states is an open question that can't be answered on a theoretical level. Instead, anti-capitalists need to be constantly mindful of the ways that states have the power to undermine anti-capitalist action through laws and through the use of force. They need to look for ways that they might use or capture state mechanisms for some anti-capitalist ends. And they need to be creative and flexible in working around the set of realities imposed by the economic dependency trap. From the abstract ideas of what's wrong with capitalism and how it's reproduced and how to think about challenge it, I'd like to now move back to the present crisis and the present set of opportunities for those of us wanting to build a just social order. The election, of course, was terrible and means a huge setback for the things that we who support social and economic justice care about. For the climate, it might mean the difference between the possibility of building a sustainable future and getting to the changes too late to avoid catastrophe. The current period is likely to give a major stress test to our constitutional and electoral systems, and those systems may not survive the next years intact. And I think it's important to start with the really actually quite frightening, I'm frightened, reality that we're facing right now. But it's also possible that with a huge setback to the politics of the neoliberal consensus under which we've been living for the last 40 years, there's an opening for more progressive alternatives to gain more traction than we have dreamed possible in recent decades. One of my favorite expressions is pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. That was said by the great Italian philosopher Antonio Gramsci. He argued that it's important to take a sober and realistic look around and understand the situation you're in and not sugarcoat it and not minimize its dangers and its troubles. At the same time, though, he argued, it was important to always reevaluate any situation for opportunities that it opens up and to put most of your attention into really pursuing those opportunities. So now I want to talk for a couple minutes about what I call cosmopolitan capitalism and nativist capitalism. The election that just happened blew a hole through one of the dominant forms of common sense in the United States political culture, that a society based on free market capitalism can be friendly to people from all races, genders, and sexual orientations, that we can have a fair and just society by being both mildly multiculturalist and pro-capitalist. This cosmopolitan capitalist view has taken a beating since the crash of 2008. Cosmopolitan capitalists favor the IMF, World Bank, and Wall Street, as well as transnational trade deals such as the TPP and NAFTA that give huge amounts of power to multinational corporations. Cosmopolitan capitalists claim that everyone is welcome. Gay rights, feminism, and anti-racism are fine as long as those things mean that everyone is welcome to compete in the capitalist market. The rich will be asked to provide for a social safety net, and progress towards social justice can be made, but the power of multinational capital and finance capital will not be challenged in any serious way. Cosmopolitan capitalists open space for social justice, but not for economic justice. The parts of the ruling class that supported that view have been running up against some walls in terms of public support ever since the crash of 2008. At that time, the sheer devastation that the crash caused in people's lives made people take stock and wonder if the system was meeting their needs. And watching as the system aided the 1% while allowing the rest of us to lose our homes and see our communities devastated created a blow against that dominant common sense. That situation made a lie out of the claim made by cosmopolitan capitalists that if we focus on challenging discrimination in our social systems while simultaneously enabling transnational capitalism to have its way most of the time, we will all do fine. Cosmopolitan capitalism didn't just take a beating in the United States. We can see the Arab Spring as a revolt against the power of the dictatorships in the Middle East, but also as a revolt against an economic system that was not delivering a viable future for millions of young people. And as those revolts were squashed, the only response that seemed to have legs for many people was a retreat into forms of fundamentalism that offered at least the possibility of cultural pride and a sense of belonging. In Europe, there's been a deep undermining of support for the mainstream social democratic and moderately conservative political parties that have largely done the bidding of transnational elites. Many people have abandoned those parties and begun to vote for newer parties. Watching the banks and the European Union bring Greece to its knees in 2015 because of its inability to pay debts that were taken out by corrupt Greek elites at the behest of transnational banks helped make many Europeans see that the system was rigged against the people. While many people have begun to support parties of the left, others have moved to support the claims of community and belonging offered by right-wing nativist parties. The part of capital that holds this cosmopolitan view can be forward-looking, rational, multicultural, liberal, supportive of the rule of law, and open to forms of regulation that stabilize the system. And sometimes it's willing to grant concessions to the working class. The cosmopolitan capitalists have tended to be open to the possibility of moving from a fossil fuel-based capitalism to a green-based system. The New Deal consensus in the United States was built on an accord between the working class and the capitalists, according to which if the working class got enough financial well-being and stability, the capitalists could continue to profit from their labor. In recent years, those cosmopolitan capitalist coalitions have largely lost their ability to win elections, in part because those at the top of the economic and political systems got too greedy, and they didn't share enough with the rest of us to make them like them and vote for them. They've been caught in the contradiction of trying to build popular support at a time when their funders and finance capital have insisted on a brutal economic squeezing of the working class. Another way to understand the inability of cosmopolitan capitalism to maintain its hegemony is that it was out-organized by the more right-wing side of the capitalist ruling class, the one that says that there's never enough for the wealthy and damn the New Deal Accord. That fraction of capital has had a different strategy for building support for an economic system that no one but the 1% would ever vote for if they really understood what was at stake and if they had other options. And that is nativist capitalism. So that alternative hegemonic worldview, nativist capitalism, won the presidency and keeps winning federal and state seats for Republicans. It's been supported by a number of unbelievably well-funded think tanks, such as the Heritage Foundation, lobbying groups such as the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, funders such as the Koch brothers, and multinational corporations such as ExxonMobil. Together, these forces have gerrymandered congressional districts, spent millions sowing doubt about climate change, worked hard to disenfranchise people who were likely to vote against them through mechanisms such as mass incarceration and voter ID laws. They've worked hard to undermine regulations that force companies to do things in ways that serve public interest, and they've fought to privatize everything from public education to our water, to Medicare and Social Security, and they've made sure that the tax system favors the 1%. They built public support for the set of policies that are the interest of a very few people by building a common sense based on racism, nativism, and sexism. The coalition that won this election got a lot of energy from a sense of aggrieved entitlement on the part of white Americans who have felt displaced. Many white Americans have been taught a version of U.S. history and a vision of U.S. culture that says that they are the normal, regular Americans who deserve material comfort and stability and security. A lot of Trump voters come from rural towns that have been devastated by the loss of family farms in the 1980s, by the loss of manufacturing jobs, by the foreclosure crisis. Many of those voters were not poor, but they did experience a real cultural loss as their communities became devastated. And it became easy for those people to blame a loss of a sense of community, stability, and a future on the multiculturalism that has risen in this past period. That politics of blame and resentment was fueled by millions of dollars invested in helping people see the world that way. This fraction of capital, the nativist capitalist, doesn't offer a functioning welfare state to get support from large numbers of people. Instead, it gains support by feeding people's fears and resentments and their sense of having been displaced culturally. Cosmopolitan capitalism doesn't speak to a lot of us because we know its claims to free market capitalism that it's a lie. It might be possible for a new labor capital accord to be built that gives enough to the working class that some working class people would vote for capital and have things be stabilized that way. But right now, those holding the reins of power are not offering enough to make that offer believable. In the face of the crisis of cosmopolitan capitalism, our job, those of us who are more progressive and on the left, needs to be to fight clearly and openly for economic and social justice. And a part of that fight has to involve developing and propagating our alternative visions of the society we want to build. So now I'm going to dig more into that. Now is not a time for us to retreat or to be moderate. Rather, it is a time to move forward and fill the void left by the implosion of the cosmopolitan capitalists and capture that very real sense of grievance and displacement that people feel at the present moment. Not the racist and nativist part of it, but the part that's genuine and that it's about people feeling a sense of a loss for their future. We know from Bernie Sanders' run for president that our ideas have much longer legs than in the US than most of us ever dreamed imaginable. Many people in this country resonate to the idea that the system is rigged, that the rich are getting richer off of our hard work, and we need to embrace that view because it is true and also because it will help build support for the policies and the projects that we support. We need to put our analysis out there that there is enough in this world for everyone to live happy and comfortable lives, that a sustainable economy is possible and can work for everyone, that we need to take the reins of power from the 1%, and that we need to invest in our communities. Building support for our vision of economic and social justice requires that we promote a vision of an alternative society, and also that we promote policies that makes people's lives better in the short term. We need to be able to explain how it is that as we build new economies, or what are called solidarity economies, we will not run afoul of the economic dependency trap of capitalism that I talked about earlier. Projects and policies that interfere with business as usual can result in companies closing and jobs being lost and real suffering for the people who depend on those jobs. So in order to lessen that economic dependency trap of capitalism and build support for a move towards a solidarity economy, meaning a sustainable economy that works for all of us, I think there's a few things that I want to put out as kind of things that we need to be organizing around and asking for. So one of them is promoting the use of alternative economic indicators. If people are told every day in the news that the cause of their poverty is a lack of economic growth, they will support pro-growth policies. We need to help people distinguish what is good for social well-being from what is good for capitalist growth. One important way to wean people off of growth is to promote the use of better economic indicators. Sometimes when an economy is growing, people do better, and sometimes they're not. Increases in well-being are always good. If we measure an economy based on things directly associated with well-being, such as literacy, longevity, and reported happiness, then we'll be able to figure out which policies are good for our economy and distinguish them from policies that increase capitalist economic activity but which may not improve well-being. And just quick examples, the states of Maryland and Vermont now both track their social progress using what's called the genuine progress indicator. It's a way of measuring an economy that some progressive economists have developed that's starting to really spread, and lots of people are using it, and some countries are using it as well. The use of the GPI in Maryland beginning in 2009 helped influence decisions to increase spending on community college and to raise the state minimum wage. Okay, number two, we need to strengthen our social safety nets. In countries without strong national health care systems and other systems of benefits, a full-time job in the formal economy becomes the required path to secure existence. In countries like Bhutan, where there are strong social bonds that allow people to care for one another, full-time employment is not necessary to obtain that sort of security. Similarly, in strongly social democratic countries such as Sweden or socialist countries such as Cuba, a full-time job isn't required either, because those countries have states, they have governments that take care of people's health care. There are a variety of paths to a social safety net, but lessening the economic dependency trap of capitalism requires that we work on developing a social safety net and making people less dependent on a full-time job to survive and have a good life. The Affordable Care Act has allowed millions of people in the United States to break their dependence on their employer for access to health care. For now, it is illegal to deny someone health insurance based on a pre-existing condition. We'll hope that lasts. Millions of people with health problems can now change jobs without worrying that change of job will leave them without medical insurance. Imagine the next step where we have single-payer insurance or Medicare for all, where people could end up not dependent on insurance companies at all to have access to health care. The third strategy for reducing the economic dependency trap that I want to talk about is work time reduction. Struggles for shorter work days can have huge benefits. The move in the industrialized countries to the 8-hour day led to huge improvements in people's well-being. France's move in the year 2000 to a 35-hour work week without a reduction in pay was a major advance. Shorter work hours have a variety of benefits. The individual spends less time in alienated labor and so has a happier life. Employers might be forced to hire someone else, and so it can lower unemployment. It helps people also with their work-family balance situation. The state of Delaware passed a policy in 2003 allowing but not requiring state workers to reduce their work time. As the next wave of automation hits our economy, we may need to advocate for even more radical ways to reduce work time, such as a guaranteed minimum income, which a lot of people are starting to talk about. Many people are beginning to advocate that tax money simply be paid to everyone to have access to the money that they need to survive, as even more jobs become obsolete in the coming years. And that's a really serious issue that I think we're going to start to hear more about. Okay, number four, we need to develop community capital. A community that is under-resourced will go to great lengths to entice companies to locate there, even if the companies offer very few benefits to a community. The mere hope of jobs and maybe a small amount of tax revenue is often enough. But what if governments or local communities had their own capital to invest in socially useful projects? In contrast to finance capital, which is always looking for a short-term return, or venture capital, which is looking for the next big thing to generate huge profits, community-based patient capital can be invested in the solidarity economy. There are more than 1,000 community development financial institutions in the United States. Generally, those are nonprofit organizations that raise funds to lend out for projects that serve the public good. There are many organizations around the country set up specifically to help finance worker-owned cooperatives. One example is the worker-owned cooperative grocery store, the Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco, has a grant program. So they use the profits from the business to actually give grants to help form other co-ops. Okay, number five, we need to wean ourselves from consumer culture. Given the billions of dollars that are spent on advertising and on commercial media to promote a high consumption lifestyle, it isn't surprising that many people think that the path to happiness is an ever higher level of consumption. But if only some people are able to experience those high levels of consumption, the total level of happiness in a society will go down. Empirical studies of happiness find that inequality breeds unhappiness, as people experience status anxiety and the social fabric becomes torn. High levels of social solidarity and connection are far more important for happiness than high levels of consumption. People need a sense of security, they need access to food and other basic needs, and they need a sense of community. Working to challenge the cultural forces that lead people to believe that consumption is the path to happiness is an important part of a move to a solidarity economy. The size of the average house in the United States has doubled since 1950, requiring more resources to build, more energy to keep comfortable, and more stuff to fill it up. And it often leads to social alienation as family members retreat more into their own private spaces. They actually find that suicide levels are higher in larger houses than they are in smaller houses. There are small house style and living in small houses are both web magazines that promote positive attributes of small houses. So the idea is for us to take really seriously the ways that we're perpetuating these ideas and to promote the idea of living within our means as a really good thing and a kind of a happy life as a low consumption life. Okay, number six. We need to promote equality. And I was astonished when I found this statistic. If we had completely equal levels of income in the United States, not wealth, but actually just income, every family of four could make $200,000 a year. And actually, I just talked to Gar Alperovitz, who I got that number from, and it turns out that actually at this point it's 220,000. We could each have 220,000. If you look it up, if you just say, what's the total personal income of the United States divided by the number of people, multiplied by four, and that's how you get that number. Similarly, if wages increased by 3% a year, which is in line with the productivity growth that we have in the United States, then every 24 years we could cut our work time in half and still have the same incomes we had at the start. That means full-time workers could all make their present salaries while working 20-hour weeks. Policies that promote equality include progressive taxation and minimum wage increases. More effective labor struggles result in larger percentage of income going to workers. And all across the country, municipalities are passing $15 minimum wage rate increases. And workers at low-wage jobs are walking out to protest and demand higher wages. So I think there's a lot that can be done, especially with the tax system, if we had good people in government, to be able to lead towards more equality. Number seven, we need to challenge ruling class actions. There's no way we can build a solidarity economy on a planet whose atmosphere has been destroyed by the fossil fuel industry. Similarly, we can't build a solidarity economy based on institutions like worker-owned cooperatives as long as transnational corporations are able to manipulate governments into supporting policies that favor them. So the fight against the Trans-Pacific Partnership was really important, and there are other trade deals that are going to be coming along that favor the transnational ruling class, and those deals tend to lead to a race to the bottom where everybody in the world is competing to have the lowest level of wages to get the capital to come to your country. As long as growth and employment rates are the measures of a healthy economy, our environmental interests will be at war with our economic interests, and what is good for capital will be seen as what's good for everyone. We need to wean ourselves off of the belief that increased GDP and more work are crucial to improving people's well-being. But we also need to transform society such that it actually is true that building solidarity projects will be the real way for people to meet their needs. At the present time, social movements are working in all of these areas that are needed to lessen the economic dependency trap of capitalism. I'm not arguing here for a new movement, but rather for a new way of understanding the relationship between these movements. If we see the ways that our work is linked, we're much more likely to build solidarity with each other. And if we have a clear sense of our path forward, we can be more optimistic that our work can add up to real lasting change. to break with the dominant way of understanding the world that offers us either cosmopolitan capitalism or nativist capitalism, we need to engage with people outside of our progressive bubbles and build a new common sense based on our view of a socially and economically just and environmentally sustainable future. Among these things we need to do to build this new common sense are, one, dialoguing with people who see the world differently from ourselves about how the world works, what interests are at play, and how best to get our needs met. Number two, propagating ways of understanding the economy that place the blame on the 1% and hold out the possibility for a world where we can all have what we need. Number three, challenging the white supremacist ideology that says that only white people deserve to live well. Number four, challenging the sexist ideology that says that women's liberation is to blame for people's loss of a sense of community. Number five, challenging the rhetoric that blames our problems on Muslims and immigrants. Number six, making clear the economic interests and cynicism of the nativist capitalists while also offering a critique of the cosmopolitan capitalists. Number seven, fighting for things like the $15 minimum wage and single-payer health care at the state level to show people what it looks like when we engage in collective action, who the forces are that we're up against, and the good that comes from challenging the 1%. And number eight, promoting alternative media that make the world make sense from our perspectives. I think it would be amazing if alternative radio stations, for example, actually reported on the economy by saying, is the GPI going up or is it going down, right? And actually started reporting on the real health of the economy as opposed to GDP sorts of things. Okay. Ever since the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, a set of beliefs has spread that is hostile to our civic culture. In earlier times, there was a strong belief that the government's important role in providing social goods, and in a sense that citizens had an obligation to pay attention to our common interests and to be informed about the actions of government and the credibility and virtue of politicians. The drumbeat of the right that government is a waste of money, that things are done best when they're left to the market, and that taxes are simply a ripoff of our private wealth, has left the public with no real understanding of a healthy relationship to the processes of governmental action. In our highly degraded democracy, people are trained into the belief that government is supposed to serve their needs without their participation in helping government function well by voting thoughtfully and by fighting to hold elected officials accountable. Instead, many people sit back and expect their needs to be met, and they rant against the system if it doesn't meet their needs. They function as consumers who want to be served, rather than as citizens who need to be engaged. We need to engage in practices that develop people's belief that by working together, we build the social fabric. When we talk together about issues and try to understand them, we can see that solutions to our social problems are at hand, but that they require concerted, collaborative work to achieve. This is a good time to rebuild our civic culture and to engage in local forms of action that help people see themselves as parts of a community that are mutually interdependent, and to break out of the extreme individualism that has developed as a part of the neoliberal capitalist culture that became descendant over the past 40 years. Whereas 20 years ago, I felt at a loss to see what kinds of work needed to be done to build a better world, now I see so many possibilities that I find myself totally overwhelmed. I know that many of you are already engaged in that work, and I want to applaud you in that work and encourage you to take pride in your accomplishments and to see yourselves as part of a team of millions around the world doing different parts of that work to build a better world. I want to ask you to not be discouraged by a feeling that you're not doing all of it, or to be negative to those who choose to pitch in a different part of the social fabric to repair than the one you've chosen to work on. And for those of you just beginning to get engaged, which I think millions of people all over this country kind of woke up and got off their couch in a way that I find really exciting, I would encourage you to pick the sort of action that feeds your soul the most and not to worry too much about whether or not it's the ultimate answer. When we build power, we also build community. And those communities need to have a deep and compelling vision of the world and of our way forward. This is a time that will take all of our efforts and a lot of vision and a lot of explaining. I'm asking everyone listening to do your work, but also to spend more time explaining what we're doing to others, and to try to propagate a vision of a socially and economically and environmentally just world. As we reweave the social fabric, we should also be remaking our society's common sense, such that also we can also bring others to see the world the way we do, and to become parts of our larger team. We want to create vibrant communities, we want to build alternative sustainable economies, and we want people to vote for policies and politicians that support those visions. Thank you so much, especially for your patience.
That That was Cynthia Kaufman on capitalism, getting past it. She spoke in Fresno, California. Cynthia Kaufman is director of the Institute of Community and Civic Engagement at De Anza College in San Francisco, where she also teaches philosophy. She's the author of Getting Past Capitalism. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in media, such as Chris Hedges, David Harvey, Angela Davis, Noam Chomsky, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Cynthia Kaufman on Capitalism, Getting Past It, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.